All right, well, let me just do a quick review of John Chrysostom, and maybe I'll just throw in something a bit extra here. He was actually known in his own lifetime as John of Constantinople, because as we learned 2 weeks ago, he became the bishop of Constantinople, and that's where he kind of played out his ministry and experienced a great deal of conflict. He was a well-known, famous orator. His preaching was very beautiful, and he was given the name John Chrysostom 100 years after his death, because Chrysostom means beautifully tongued, or John the silver-tongued preacher, essentially, is what that means. And so that is a name that was given to him after his death, about 100 years after his death. You will remember that he kind of rose through the ranks of being a deacon and then a presbyter as he did some study. He studied under some monastics. He lived the monastic life somewhat. Then he was ordained a deacon, then a presbyter, which we are understanding to primarily just sort of be a local pastor. And then eventually he became the bishop of Constantinople. You also remember, of course, that we discussed last time. We had quite a few different discussions last time. However, we talked about sort of this increasing division between Rome and Constantinople, just different trends, sort of cultural trends, church-style kinds of trends between Rome and Constantinople, between the West and the East. We ourselves being much more familiar with Western tradition, as well as more familiar with the Roman Catholic Church or the Western Church, because our heritage is a Reformation heritage, and of course the big fight was between the Reformation leaders and the Roman Catholic Church, not so much the Eastern Church. It just wasn't sort of on the map, so to speak, at that point. He really did a great job of cleaning up the Eastern Church, of cleaning up the clergy and their lifestyle. Remember, they were living with women, even though some of them claimed to be celibate. Others were becoming quite wealthy and living in great luxury. And so he cleaned that up. And eventually the finances, because the finances were in shambles of the church there at Constantinople, he actually sold some of the luxurious items that were a part of the quote-unquote bishop's palace and used those things to feed the poor, actually, and to minister to the ordinary needs of people. So that's about as far as we got 2 weeks ago. And now we're going to talk about some of his other enemies. So you will remember that John Chrysostom had this primary enemy. His name was Eutropius, and Eutropius was the chamberlain underneath the emperor. He stood against Eutropius by allowing refugees to take refuge in the church. Eventually, Eutropius himself made enough people mad that he took refuge inside the church. And John Chrysostom was faithful to his calling, really, to prevent soldiers to carry out violence inside the walls of the church. He did that. He prevented the soldiers from carrying out any violence against his own enemy, Eutropius, because he had taken refuge in the church. But Eutropius, out of fear, left the facilities. He left the building, so to speak, and was killed by a mob in the streets. Now, if you count the bullet points up from the bottom of the first page, this is kind of where we're going to start. 1, 2, 3 up from the bottom of the first page. So, John Chrysostom was, as we know, a silver-tongued orator and a very bold preacher. And that meant that Eutropius wasn't his only enemy. So, the emperor's wife, Eudoxia, felt some real angst as she was sitting in the worship services as well, because he would preach against extreme wealth and luxury and extravagance, and she felt as if whenever he preached on that, everybody was looking at her, which may or may not have been true. You know, you don't know whether or not he is sort of preaching specifically with her in mind. Nevertheless, she thinks, what can I do about this? And she makes several special, special grants to the church. She sort of places some of her extravagance into the hands of the church. She gives some luxurious grants to the church. And what does John Chrysostom do? He just keeps preaching, And perhaps what we're seeing happen is just the Holy Spirit is convicting her, and she's doing the classic shoot the messenger reaction. So he just continues to preach. She continues to feel this tension and this angst as she hears that. And so at one point, he goes out of town. He goes out of town on some church business related to Ephesus. And she, with some others, plot together to trump up some charges against John Chrysostom while he is away. They hold sort of a kangaroo court, and they find John Chrysostom guilty. And consequently, the emperor, who is quite weak, is prodded into banishing him. So it's been a while since we've talked about banishment, right? We talked about this some before, because pastors were, like John the Apostle, were getting banished out of their city of service because of persecution. Now it's because of intrigue. The empire, quote unquote, the empire is Christian, quote unquote. They shouldn't banish a pastor because, no, we want to go back to paganism. So they trump up these charges against John Chrysostom. And because the emperor himself is quite weak at this particular time, he banishes John to somewhere outside of his city. And as you will see, it turns out to not be quite far enough. So what happens after that is a number of other bishops encourage John Chrysostom to call a synod. So we would think of synods normally as councils like the Council of Constantinople that established Trinitarian doctrine in a very concise kind of way. But they could call synods in other ways as well, and they would have especially used a synod in something like this. So in a lot of ways, John Chrysostom should have been condemned or considered innocent by a synod of other bishops, but instead it was more of this kangaroo court kind of thing that we mentioned. So other bishops are saying, all right, John Chrysostom, why don't you call your own synod and condemn those who recently condemned you, kick them out of the church, and everything will be okay. He refused to do that. He refused to sort of play the political game, and he turned himself over to the soldiers that were there to escort him out of the city. However, the people were furious. Remember, again, he's very silver-tongued. He's a very popular preacher. And so the people are furious. There were rumors in the streets of the possibility of a mutiny against the king, against the emperor. And it got so bad that the emperor, his wife Eudoxia, and the army didn't dare show themselves on the streets, lest they be, attacked by these mobs of furious people. Eventually, Eudoxia, who had trumped up charges against him and had, sort of worked, finagled this kangaroo court to condemn him, she had to beg him to come back to the city to restore order. So, in some sense, he is kind of, justified. He is considered by the people to be innocent of these charges. He's vindicated. So, any comments or questions about that? Yes. Once again, kind of a tense relationship all along the way. Yeah, Marge. Okay, sure. So we are now on the back page of that, and we've covered the first two bullet points. So he made an enemy, Eutropius, then Eudoxia, and once, both times, he's vindicated. However, Chrysostom was banished again, and it's again because of his preaching. So just like Eudoxia feels the people's eyes boring holes into her whenever he preaches about extravagance and luxury, the general population of nobility and the wealthy, they could not stand his powerful preaching, and so he's banished again. Again, not far enough. So this time, he is not sort of vindicated by a mob or by a riot. He simply goes away and he takes up his pen. And Innocent, who is the bishop of Rome, all right, and we might even be able at this point to refer to him as the Pope. Okay? So some textbooks, some historical articles would refer to him as Innocent, the Bishop of Rome. Others would refer to him as Pope Innocent. But whatever be the case there, Innocent, the Bishop of Rome, who is in many ways John Chrysostom's equal at this point, right? One is the Bishop of Rome, one is the Bishop of Constantinople. He takes up the cause of Chrysostom, basically thinking to himself, look, if the nobility can do this to him, the nobility could do this to me, and so I need to take up his cause. And they sort of write together. So there's some letters that are written that Innocent writes to support John Chrysostom. However, because he's not far enough away, he's not out into sort of the hinterlands far enough, so to speak, people are reading his writings. They are reading his letters. You know, it's just as bad as having him preach in church every week. The modern equivalent of this is they couldn't shut down his website. Okay, they could refuse him entrance to the church, but they could not shut down his website. And so he is re-banished where there is no Wi-Fi, so to speak. He is taken to a much farther place away. The indication that we receive, at least from some historians, is that there was delay along the way. There was a refusal to provide him with the normal care that he should have needed at his sort of age and some of his physical condition. And because of that neglect, he died on the journey, on the way to this other place where he was going to be banished to. And there are some, there's some artwork related to his death where he goes to a small church and receives communion there. And again, we're kind of seeing that, although he was not quote-unquote Catholic, we're seeing that more medieval kind of emphasis on the last rites and the desire to receive prayer or communion at your deathbed. But nevertheless, he received communion in a small church that was on near the road that he was on the way to his second banishment, or his re-second banishment, or whatever you want to call it. So, any comments or questions there on that as well? Go ahead, Don. Yes, they would have seen that way, but my understanding is that this is more of a political banishment, that he, none of the bishops necessarily would have considered him excommunicated. This was a banishment by the emperor. Right, that's correct. Yes, so if you don't like my preaching, what do? You go find a different church, typically. Typically, that's kind of what happens. They couldn't do that. That was not really an option for them. To leave, there would technically have only been one church in every city. Now, there would have been satellite churches in a large city like Constantinople. But if you were the emperor's wife and you didn't go to the main church, which was St. Sophia in Constantinople, you didn't go to the main church, something was drastically wrong. And so she was going to get rid of him because she wasn't going to leave the church. Which sometimes, if you don't like the preacher's preaching, that's also what churches try to do. But, you know, just going down the road to another church just wasn't an option for them. Now, I do want to kind of draw a contrast here, and I can't remember for certain if I emphasized this last time or not, but I do want to kind of draw a contrast. So, essentially, John Chrysostom is banished by the emperor, or banished by the politicians, because that eastern half of the empire is still strong. It's still has a workable government. There is still wealth and strength in that eastern portion of the empire. So think of it, you know, there is still a lot of trade going on in that portion of the empire. They are to some degree more dependent on trade than upon agriculture and some other things. In the west, the empire is crumbling. And eventually, the West falls. The barbarians from the north, so to speak, are going to invade Rome around the same time. So the empire is crumbling there. And you will remember that Ambrose of Milan, which is north in Italy, Ambrose of Milan, he humiliated the emperor, right? Do you remember this? The emperor wanted to make a gift. He brought it in. He laid it on the altar, and nobody would come and receive the gift. No one would even acknowledge that, you know, the head honcho just showed off, and the head honcho just gave us this beautiful, wonderful, wealthy gift. Ambrose just stood off to the side and waited and waited and waited and waited and humiliated the emperor, and then he came and received the gift. It's kind of like, I'm going to humiliate you, and I'm going to take your gift too. You know, obviously, Ambrose was the more powerful man. That's the exact opposite of what happens in Constantinople and then the eastern half of the empire. The emperor humiliated Chrysostom. He banished Chrysostom. That pattern would hold true for many centuries. The power of the empire in the east would remain relatively strong for another 1,000 years. So John Chrysostom is not the first patriarch of Constantinople to be banished by an emperor. And Ambrose of Milan was not the first bishop to humiliate an emperor in the West. So there's kind of this ongoing pattern of a strong church, stronger than the government in the West, and a strong government stronger than the church in the East. Any comments or thoughts on that? Go ahead, Jim. Oh, corrupt?
Corrupt.
As I don't really know for sure. I mean, we're seeing evidence of a corrupt. Perverted and sensual. I don't know. Typically, with that kind of unmitigated power goes a lot of sexual vice, so I wouldn't be surprised. Any other comments or questions? All right, so now we're going to move from the east back over to the west. So John Chrysostom being in the east, now Jerome being in the west. Obviously, Jerome born in northern Italy around 348 AD. And many people refer to him as Saint Jerome. I mean, we don't tend to do that. We don't say Saint Augustine, you know, or Saint Athanasius, you know, but other traditions have for centuries referred to these as saints. But unless you're going to call me Saint Rodney, you know, and I'm going to call you Saint Brad or whatever, you know, I mean, they didn't think of this as in the biblical terms of every Christian is a saint and a sinner at the same time. They are thinking of these great Christian leaders and kind of setting them aside as special saints. But nevertheless, Jerome, he was not very saintly, okay? He was not a humble, peaceful person. He was stormy. He was proud. He tended to pick fights. And at times could be a bitter enemy. He was unruly and obstinate at times. But God did use him in one particular way, and we'll get to that here towards the end. He very much wanted to be a monk. However, he did so at least partly to try to rid himself with his obsession with sex. So he did go into a monastic kind of lifestyle. However, he was still plagued with memories and with dreams of dancers in Rome that he had observed. He sought to suppress his drive by punishing his body and living an especially austere lifestyle, which kind of leads us to the point of God has given marriage for multiple purposes, one of which is the safety of sex within marriage and dealing with his sex drive by sort of beating his body up in some ways, living this very austere lifestyle, monastic lifestyle, you know, kind of bread and water type thing, was not the right way. It was not the right way to deal with that. And nor is it even today the right way to do so. The whole celibate priesthood idea is unbiblical and is counterintuitive and just doesn't even make common sense. I mean, just obviously for many, many reasons that have come into the light of day in our own lifetimes with the priest sex scandals. Just obviously, they should have learned Jerome's lesson here, that this is not going to work. that is his experience as well. He carried this out in some rather unusual ways. He decided at one point that because he had been washed by Christ from his sins, that he never needed to wash again, and he stopped bathing. All right? You know, so just, you know, come on. This is so unusual. This is so, you know, odd. But these kinds of things felt more common at that time. Remember, we talked about, I believe it was one of the Gregories. It was either Gregory of Nazianzus or it was Gregory of Nyssa. One of those two, they were, you know, somebody that was kind of against them. They didn't want their bishop to be this guy that smelled bad and only wore rags. So, you know, this kind of thing was more common. Now, I want to just cover the next bullet point, and then I want to pause and talk about some of just how odd some of these things seem to our own modern mindset and discuss that a little bit. But here we go. So he stopped bathing for some period of time. However, eventually, he did find some peace and stability, even kind of dealing with his sex drive, in the company of some devout women in Rome. And there is no indication that there was anything going on between them romantically. One of them would have been similar to his age. Another would have been something like a daughter's age. And he sort of treated her with the kindness of a father. So he kind of finds this peace in their midst. I don't think I even wrote down any of their names, but they were studious, and he could kind of interact with them on an intellectual level, and he found it to be safe for them. I think in some ways he's a competitive, bombastic man who couldn't get along with other guys who were often also competitive. And so he found the company of these women, these devout intellectual women in Rome, to be something he could get along with them. So he could connect with them. Some of them, this mother and daughter couple, were especially instrumental in basically getting him involved in basic Bible study. So he wouldn't just be studying sort of the classics, so to speak, the Greek and Roman classics and sort of some of the more ethereal kind of theology. He would, with them, they would just study the Bible. And that was kind of helpful for him. Now, don't some of these things just feel so unusual? You know, a monk who stops bathing, you know, vows of silence. The whole idea of celibacy is increasing at this time of history. There would be fewer and fewer bishops who were married and having children. Things like, you know, a guy who can't get along, so he hangs out with these two women all the time, and they're sort of ministry, Bible study partners, you know, which we would typically see as rather unusual. What is your response to this? Go ahead.
It seems like going to the mindset, if I do this thing, then I'll be better, rather than focusing on works.
Okay. Yeah, so there is kind of, there is some deviation from salvation by grace through faith. There is this tendency to be, even if these people are genuine Christians, they feel like they're sort of earning their standing with God. There is an emphasis, there's sort of a legalistic emphasis. Yes. And when you have a legalistic emphasis, you're going to do weird things. You know? Instead of talking about modesty, you're going to measure women's or girls' skirts. And I've been to schools where the girls had to kneel down and they measured the length of their skirt. Okay? You're going to measure boys' hair over their ears. You know, and that's, you know, again, we make our boys get haircuts. But you don't, you know, you just do some weird things when you have a legalistic emphasis. And that's part of what's going on here. Anything else? What other responses do you have to some of these oddities in church history? Okay. Yes. So there is an element of discipline going on in this more monastic kind of lifestyle that does provide focus. That would be correct. Yes. Go ahead. Right, to remain as I am. Right, so Paul did say, I would prefer that you remain as I And in that whole context of 2 Corinthians chapter 7, he says that a married man must please his wife. However, a single man, one who remains unmarried, is able to please the Lord. And so, to me, they are taking that, you know, kind of beyond balance, so that only unmarried men can be in the ministry. I mean, that's just not even in the conversation for Paul. Other than, as an illustration, he's in the ministry. But Peter was in the ministry too, and he specifically refers to Peter and his wife traveling with him. So, but yes, it does stem from sort of that biblical emphasis on an unmarried man is able to focus on pleasing the Lord. Anything else? One of the things that I kind of want to point out is there are things that happen in our churches that might appear just as unusual to them. Right? So, is Community Bible Church going to get written up in the history books? No. But some of the more innovative churches will get written up into the history books that are contemporaneous with us. And some of those churches have a Starbucks inside their lobby. And so, if the Lord tarries, you know, 500 years... 500 years from now, churches are going to be looking back and going, can you believe that? You know, they will not read about Community Bible Church, who just sort of does ordinary church every week, you know. They won't read about us, but they'll read about the churches that had a Starbucks in their lobby. And so there are things that happen in the modern church that would appear just as unusual to these historical people, or would appear, will appear, if the Lord tarries, you know, down the centuries, people reading back about our period of time, they'll kind of go, what? About us as well. So maybe so. This strange brand of churches that didn't have silliness going on or whatever, yeah. And so, I think that we want to emphasize what would be called continuity. Did these people believe in Christ? Did they believe the Bible to be the Word of God? Did they seek to please the Lord? Did they believe the core doctrines of the faith? Yes. The way they expressed that can be very different at times and would feel foreign to us. Having communion every single week, that would feel foreign to us. And in some ways, sort of the pomp and circumstance that is beginning to rise would begin to feel very, very foreign to us. But our sort of simplicity would begin with that, if they were transported to our century and to a worship service in our church, that would feel very unusual to them as well. So, all right. Now, if you count up from the bottom, I'm going to count up to where I'm at. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 from the bottom there. Jerome made enemies easily because he was so tactless. Eventually, he came to kind of be protected by the Bishop of Rome. Eventually, that bishop dies, and he loses his protector. And so the people who are irritated by him are going to continually cause problems for him, and so he moves. He goes from Rome to the Holy Land, or as he puts it, I'm moving from Babylon to Jerusalem. And that is where he devoted himself to translating the Bible. So someone had kind of put this idea into his head when he first moved to Rome. This particular bishop, who has now died in the story, put this idea. He said, I think that you are talented. I think you're educated. You should start translating the Bible into Latin. However, he didn't really devote himself to that until he had moved to the Holy Land. There had been other Latin translations of the Old Testament, but they had been translated from the Greek Septuagint. So do you remember that at about 70 BC, there was a translation from the Masoretic text, from the Hebrew text, into Greek? Because we all know, right, in New Testament times, everybody spoke Greek. There were lots of Jews that were living all over the world. They didn't know Hebrew. They could not read their own scriptures. And so Hebrew scholars gathered together. They translated the Hebrew into a Greek Old Testament. It's called the Septuagint. And it served that part of the Hebrew population that could no longer read Hebrew. So these translations into Latin were translated from that Greek. So do you see how that's kind of a two-step system? It goes from Hebrew to Greek, and then it goes to Latin. Well, there can be some things lost in translation, and now you have translations going on twice, so even more can be lost. So the idea was, Jerome, you don't get along so well with people, so go study somewhere and translate directly from the Hebrew to the Latin, which is what he did. However, there were a lot of people who didn't like it. They loved their old Bibles that had been translated first from the Hebrew to the Greek, then from the Greek to the Latin. And some of them even felt as if the Septuagint itself was inspired. So there was this story. Do you want to hear the story? Well, too bad. Here we go. The story, kind of the legendary story that grew up around the Septuagint is that 70, Septuagint means 70, okay? So around 70 BC, and 70 different scholars all over the world independently translated from the Hebrew to the Greek, and then they all brought them together, and they matched perfectly. This was God. You know, this was God giving his signature of approval on this translation because they all matched. These independent translators, they all came up with exactly the same thing. And so because this legendary kind of a story built up around the Septuagint, so people loved it, and they felt like any translation of the Old Testament should come from the Septuagint. Others felt like Jerome was changing the Bible. In reality, what Jerome was doing was he was doing a more accurate translation by working directly from the Hebrew. And Augustine himself, who we uphold as one of the most important theologians of really all of church history, Augustine himself criticized Jerome. He criticized him for changing the Bible, that the Septuagint was good enough. He should have started with the Septuagint instead of going back to the Hebrew. Also, at some point in this mix, you're starting to see anti-Semitism, right? So why would we need to go back to the Hebrew? You know, those Jews don't even believe in Jesus anyway. Why would we need to go back to the Hebrew? Let's just start with the Septuagint. That's the Old Testament, good enough for me, so to speak. And so even Augustine had these preferences and was critical of Jerome. Most of the time, if you picked a fight with Jerome, you never got along with him again. However, that was not the case for Augustine, because Jerome saw the need to fight against the Pelagian heresy, which we will talk about next week. It's basically a works-based salvation. He saw the need to fight against that, and he recruited Augustine to help him. So here, these two had a little tiff about Bible translations, but they saw heresy on the horizon, and they set aside their differences so that they could fight together against the Pelagian heresy. Towards the end of his life, Jerome felt very lonely. He marked the passing of a generation of Christian leaders, kind of the passing of an era. 10 years before he died, Rome was sacked by the Goths, and that was news. It really did sort of shake the world that somehow Rome or Constantinople, either one of them, just was, you know, they felt like they should have been protected by God. Just like the Jews in Jesus' time felt like Jerusalem, God was obligated to Jerusalem, just like they felt that way, Christians felt that same way about Rome, and the barbarians from the north, the Germanic tribes, took over Rome. And that prompts Augustine to do some of his greatest theological writing in the book called The City of God. And so both Jerome and Augustine are kind of seeing a complete change of what is happening in the western part of the empire as well as the church. And Jerome sort of felt, he could sense that this era is passing, and he felt very much alone. All right, are there any comments or questions from the things that we've said here? All right, well, thanks for listening in on this. One more lesson on church history, and we'll take up with the life of Augustine next week. You are dismissed.